You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
In Sound Poetry today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to have a medley of two poets that we have recorded in the past, both very fine voices, Robert Michael Pyle, the poet of the rivers of southeast Washington, and Michael Schmeltzer of Seattle, the editor of various books of poetry. They are, I think, very well suited to one another in theme, and there is a synthesis, I think, that you'll find quite enjoyable in the animal nature of both of these readings.
Here's a little short one called Road to the River. Judy and I did not build her wonderful photographs you can't see on this program, or the poems around one another usually, but this is one that was directly inspired by one of Judy Vandermaten's extremely evocative photographs. This is called Road to the River. Turn down any lane off the 14, the 4, or 30. Drive as far as you can. When you hit a fence or the end of the track, get out and walk. Keep walking. You'll smell it first as the onshore wind freshens. Smell of mud and crayfish shells, fish, otter spraint, and rot. Don't stop walking. Don't stop until your feet get wet. And then, why, you'd better stop. And here's where you don't have to stop, where you have a bridge. This is a paean to all the bridges on the river. But I wrote this one for my dear friend, Florence Sage, who's a splendid poet in Astoria, and she's my poetry partner. I crossed the Columbia. How many times have I crossed this river? 500? 1,000? First time, 1964, with my mother, bringing me by rail from Colorado to see her beloved Northwest. It took. So there were many crossings to come on the Portland Rose, the City of Portland, and eventually Amtrak, or sometimes Greyhound. Seattle to Denver and back again. Later, in a dynasty of Volkswagens, it was I-5 and 205, the Bridge of the Gods, Hood River, the Dalles, Biggs, Umatilla, Vernita, and Vantage. For jobs, field trips, family, all the reasons one has for changing states of being. When I moved downstream to a lower trib, crossing shifted to the Lewis and Clark in Longview, the ferry at Westport in Honda, Toyota, Subaru. Now I cross the river more than ever before, at Magler, the last bridge before the bar. And gladly so, for when I cross the Columbia now, I'm crossing it to you.
Written to a friend.
Yeah, my dear friend, my girlfriend, Reedy. But we're poetry friends as well. I'm so lucky that my companion is a wonderful poet who reads everything I read, and I read what she reads, and we don't collaborate as such, but I think we're pretty good editors for one another, or at least advisors. And it makes a big, big difference to have someone with whom you spend time who cares as much about poetry as you do and who makes it herself.
Well, in some respects, this one also is a road trip that's sort of autobiographical, because you did come from Colorado having grown up there, right?
Absolutely right, I did. And in fact, the first time I crossed the Columbia was when my mother brought me west in 1964 to see the University of Washington. Part of that trip was on the train, part of it by rental car.
Yeah.
But we crossed the Columbia probably for the first time at Umatilla coming up from Pendleton. And then after that at Vantage over to Yakima. And so I went, many bridge crossings since then. But you know, as far as autobiography goes, I often think I'd love to read the memoir of a mammal other than a human. In fact, there are a couple of places you can do that. One of my favorite books is a British novel of greatly beloved called Tarka the Otter. by Henry Williamson, who is a wonderful countryside writer about the time of W.H. Hudson, late 19th, early 20th century. He wrote lots of books in which landscape plays a very large role, as it does, of course, in Thomas Hardy and a lot of the writers of that time, and still does. But he wrote this book about an otter called Tarka the Otter, which was essentially almost written as, it wasn't first person, but it was virtually a closely told biography of this one otter. And I've always thought how wonderful to be able to tell the world through the eyes and senses of a different animal. So here's my little version, not a whole life, but part of an afternoon in the life of one muskrat. And I will say that this poem, I tend to write grammatically. My line breaks matter. They do. They're carefully thought of. But I often write in entire sentences, and often with punctuation, though not always. This poem is one complete sentence. It's of a Thoreauvian length. Nobody gets away with sentences like this in prose these days. But I will tell you this. It's entirely grammatical. If anybody still knew how, you could diagram this sentence. It's called What the Muskrat Saw. What the muskrat saw slipping through the marsh beneath the striders as the beaver, 10 times his size, slid through the pond beside the dam where aspen lay akimbo, stripped of bark above the runnel where the rainbow rose to meet the hatch of caddis at the riffle of the kingfisher's rattle through the willow's shadow, on the river where the cottonwood leaf floated over sandy bottoms scored with crayfish holes and rocks all coated with snails, whose tentacles quivered at the passage of the blennies and the scissor of the heron's bill, which came up empty for a change because the mink disturbed the fish a moment early, and they in turn alarmed a frog that leapt upon a fallen log where otters sunned before returning upstream to the marsh where the muskrat, slipping underneath the striders, saw him and rose into his reedy house.
Yes, that's a long shot in film language.
I can't do it in one breath.
There have been some songs of that sort. Do you remember Nielsen's The Point?
Oh, yes.
Where he talks about a drop of water that eventually becomes that drips and runs into the river and all the way to the ocean. This has that kind of flow where you're jumping from lily pad to land to, you know, and it moves very, very, very fluidly. There is, of course, some water language here. I mean,
a little bit,
water creatures and so forth, right, muskrat. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, so it works beautifully. And filmically, it would be a very interesting pixelated poem, you know, in cartoon.
You know, it would, wouldn't it? It would be. I hadn't thought of that, David. I'd love to see.
Just a minute of animation.
These things happening. I'd love to see that happen. Do you know people who can do that?
I don't know people who are skilled at doing it in a really old-fashioned way. And I'm sure digital programs now would allow people to do this easily.
CGA, computer-generated animation.
Right, right.
Well, you know that my book, Where Bigfoot Walks, was recently made into a film, as you mentioned, called The Dark Divide. People can look it up. The website is just darkdividefilm.com. It's streaming on all the services except for Netflix. And it was in theaters for a while. It actually was in some live theaters this year. But that film is beautifully made. And it takes place in the Cascades. And it became a feature film instead of a documentary, as it was going to be. Stars David Cross playing me and Deborah Messing playing my late wife. It's beautifully done. But it has some computer generated butterfly action. Most of the butterfly action is real, but there are some. So maybe I'll track down the artist who did that for the movie and ask him if he could take a whack at this poem.
And, did you, by the way, you found some butterflies that were new to you on that trip in the gorge, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And in the wider picture, the story concentrates it there, but in the wider story, I found several other types related to that in the research associated, and I was able to name one of those for my late wife, Tia. It became Tia's copper butterfly, Lysina mariposa Tia. So that made me happy. I will give you credit on that movie, David. You'll be the originator.
you also, in traveling for butterfly searches, mentioned that the west side, the moist side of the state, isn't always the best for really discovering butterflies, especially not under the canopy sometimes. But you go on the east side and butterflies might be more plentiful. Is it still the case that you find rarely many butterflies in the forests here?
Yes, it is the case. There are some species that are pretty well adapted. So any day now, in fact, I think you know the great Olympia poet Bill Yake. I believe you know. He's probably been on the program. If not, he should be. He wrote me today. He's a good butterfly man too. And Bill wrote me today that he saw his first butterfly this spring yesterday, which was his birthday. And that species, called the margined white, comes out early, like the spring azure, which Robert Frost wrote a poem about called Blue Butterfly Day. He talks about the sky flakes down and one-on-one on the mud, and how the flowers will have to hurry to catch up with the sky flakes unless they hurry. That butterfly does well in the forested west side. The western tiger swallowtails do pretty well, especially in our towns. But on the whole, the west side, because it's moister, cloudier, more forested, the butterflies are not as well adapted, where it's cool and moist, as they are to a hot, moist place like the tropical rainforest or the east side of the mountains in the canyons. Those lovely, moist canyons in the springtime when you get the early sun over around Yakima and Okanagan and so on, that's very rich butterfly country indeed. So down where I live in Wakayama County, with its 120 inches of rain every year, is probably the worst butterfly county in the country. So why did a butterfly guy settle there? Well, that I go into that in other books.
Well, I'm sure that gastropods also get your attention.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, I started, and I have a book called The Thunder Tree that about my childhood in Colorado, and it talks about how I began as a naturalist, as a conchologist, as a shell collector. I was crazy. I was mad crazy about seashells as a boy from the age of 7. And I lived in Colorado. It was the dumbest place to be a young conchologist you could imagine. Spent all my allowance on seashells from the museum. I belonged to a shell of the month club. Did anything to get some seashells. And then I began to notice that there were a few more butterflies around than shells. I was a slow study, but I finally made the adaptive leap over to butterflies. And then, of course, I moved here where there's a lot more gastropods than there are butterflies. So I was behind the eight ball.
I did mention that I used to see many more of them in Point Defiance than I do now. It's as though they vanished from the trails, even those slimy, muddy trails that we used to walk and run. And I used to question, why don't we see them so much anymore?
Are you speaking about butterflies or banana slugs?
The banana slugs, the gastropods that... the
land snails, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And well, I don't know why. There's just not, I'm not such a noticer of them, even on a walk through the woods.
And Point Defiance should be very good because it's big enough and wild enough. It has some old growth. I was just reading in my journal about my first visit there in 1970 and how struck I was by the size and wildness of Point Defiance. It certainly should still have, I'm sure they're still there, but I think the numbers of the banana slugs have been reduced in part by competition and possibly predation by the introduced European slugs, which are the brown slugs are not as interesting. They're still wonderful mollusks, but they're not native. And some think that they compete to the detriment of the banana slugs. I can't think of another reason. It hasn't warmed up enough yet to drive out the banana slugs. Keep your eyes open. Let me know what you see.
Keep looking, yeah. Yes. Keep hiking.
Well, David, as I wrap down in the reading here, I'd like to read two more, if I may.
Do it.
One of them is not the happiest poem in the book, but I just referred to my late wife, Tia, who was the light of my life for many years. And this poem comes around to her at the end, but I didn't know it would. Poem that I had no idea where it would go. And that's how a poem should be, isn't it?
Yeah.
Patty Ann Rogers has said this, but so did Robert Frost and others, that if you're not surprised by the poem, how can the reader or the listener be surprised? Uh-huh. And so the feeling that I've done well by an idea for a poem is if it goes someplace I did not intend to go, and it ultimately causes me to raise my eyebrows and say, how did I get there? So this poem does that. And bear with me. It's not a happy poem, but it's one that does bear, I hope, redemption. It's called Ceremony, and it invokes the river in a completely different way. The roadkill was black, long, red at one end. A vulture went back to look. My God, it's a bear. A tiny bear, tumped up against the guardrail. 18 inches, maybe 10 pounds tops. Smaller than my cat, certainly skinnier. A tiny teddy, head crushed. That's why the red. Sad, shocked, toss him into the brush. Better anyway than hard asphalt. But it doesn't sit right, like I haven't done right by the bear. Some ceremony? A better, softer resting place? Go back today. Heavy, brambly scramble down steep slope through cans and plastic, ferns and furs, rotting branches. Hang on to sword fern with its naphthalene smell. Hang over punji stakes of alder slash. Back and forth across that no man's land between highway and life. No sign. I guess the coyotes took him already. But then, down final slope, the bear, shiny fur, like acrylic in the sun, hung up in Salal. So I lift him. He's a little boy, by a paw, less than a bag of sugar. Farther down, mossy maple sticks out toward river. Teddies belong on beds, says the little boy and me. Cinch way out the broad trunk. Lay little bear on his tummy on the bowl. Stuff his busted jaw back in. Close his mouth with moss. Lay paw over rubbery snout, the way my cat likes to sleep. Feel those long half-circle claws, thick and sharp. Those soft, cool pads, like an old man's feet wrinkled by the rain. Run my fingers through the soft fur that clothes that baby's body. Dry now, silky, warm in the evening sun. And then clamber back up to the road and down again with four long wands of false Solomon seal, fragrant as orange blossom. Squinch out the trunk again to lay the creamy ray seams around that shattered little head you'd never know. Say some words for the bear, for the world. Tug once more his velvet elfin ears. Turn, jump down, and go. Feel better now. But later, over wine, I have to ask, who was it all for? Some spirit bear? I don't think so. For the little bear? Well, a bear is just a bear, and the bear didn't care. Raven watched the proceedings, and tomorrow the vultures will visit. Flowers scatter, little bear go back. So again I ask, who was it for? And for whom did I play the ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest at my brother's funeral? lay new cottonwood shoots on his beautiful cottonwood box? And for whom did I wash my own love's body, dress her in soft white cotton and flowers?
Well, with that beautiful elegy to nature in several of its forms, I think that's a beautiful conclusion for your readings, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. This is Radio Tacoma. I've been your host on Sound Poetry, and we have had the pleasure to be regaled with the riverine poetry of Robert Michael Pyle, better known as Bob Pyle when you get to know. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, David, and you just used one of my favorite words, riverine.
Michael Schmelzer of Seattle.
Armor and the fabulous softness, hard and the soft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Armor and the fabulous softness. The fabulous softness of chinchilla fur is what caused the extinction of one species, the two remaining now endangered. We wear our lives like a lavish shawl we inherited and did nothing to earn. We wear polished armor to war and thick furs upon return, as if by covering our battle-mangled bodies with the most vulnerable pelts, we could shield the stone fist of our heart, which, if need be, we would tear from our chest and bludgeon our enemies with it, crush their heads while children cower, their soft, silken hair offering no protection either. The baby rabbit, whose white coat we are invited to pet, trembles. The yellow chick, bright as a dandelion, shivers. Be gentle, the volunteer warns us, and the children at the petting zoo who have gathered around to hold something so helpless, even they have dominion over it. They make of themselves pudding, peach fuzz, part sugar and full fur. You can stroke it with the back of your hand, the woman says. And the children do, every one of them obedient to the delicate. The chick, a droplet of yolk. The rabbit, that tiny god of scrambling limbs. With two fingers, we can snuff them out like a match. My God, our brutal and fragile fires, these calloused hands on my daughter's incomprehensibly soft cheeks.
You strive for the softest softness at times in that one, mm-hmm. trying to find that moment of just before you stroke the fur mm-hmm. of the trembling fragile creature. Yeah, is that one that you would read to your children at all? Or some verses of that?
When they're interested, I would say. Absolutely not. They know that I write and they've seen my books, but they are just not interested in what I'm writing currently. Maybe at some point they know that I do the editing and that I help publish other people's work and I've had work published, but on the whole, they just know me as dad and just, you know.
Gosh, they could come alive to so many mysteries. And when you confess who you are, learn a little bit from those verses.
Yeah,
is he telling the truth here?
They see the absurd part. They see the part of me that loves clouds. And my youngest had said, like, remember that day daddy fell in love with the cloud? Because I could not stop talking about the shape of it and the pattern that it had. So they see the poetic in me, and they don't need to necessarily read the poetry to understand that the lens that I have is what I think matters in poetry. So I hope that part is being you know, generously given to them, and that they can see the world through a certain kind of lens as well.
So you think it'd be a kind of sadism to have them sit quietly for a minute and say, I want you to listen to this.
Yeah. There are just some things that I think, you know, they will learn about on their own and in their own way. And we can have discussions then. But at this time, I still want them to be as innocent as possible. And some of the stuff I write about, I'm like, I don't want you to know about that. They'll learn. The world will teach them in their its own way. So,
well, I hope our audience on Radio Tacoma is enjoying all of the moments of your reading. You read beautifully. And we have a final work that you gave me for this program of readings called Joy Apoptosis. Not the easiest of words to have in a title to prepare the reader, but let's talk about it after you've read it and see whether or not we've got the ingredients of the apoptosic.
Okay. Joy Apoptosis. When I wake, I drop my death like a bomb from the highest mount I know. Then I begin my day whistling. The way cream swirls light into coffee, the way sugar sweetens while disappearing. This is how I blend myself into my daughters. I'm growing old. War repeats itself on the news, but I managed to surrender my fear. I set every last sadness ablaze, the way soldiers burn the huts they raid. Now I'm extinguished by a maple dark exhaustion. I've left my family, nothing in my will, but joy like a pinwheel spinning. I tuck my children in. I kiss their heads as I would kiss this ravaged world, tenderly, as pushing a pin back into a grenade.
Michael Schmelzer, the poetry of the harsh, horrific, and the tender, the vulnerable. We've enjoyed very much your reading, but we can't leave without knowing about an apoptosis of joy. What is that? Why do we do this once in a while? Put in an incredibly unusual word in a repertoire of poems, really, that have been so cognitively manageable, nothing to tax, and then there's this one.
So for me, I am interested in a lot of various things, and I read a lot of various texts, and I love reading about black holes. I think they're mysterious and strange. And that first image they had of the black hole was terrifying to me in this way. Like it's just such a strange object. And then for this, for apoptosis, it essentially means cell death, I believe, the way things can just deteriorate. And for me, there's a certain kind of up and down that I will go through at times. And it's hard for me to be in the present a lot of times. And that's why I think I have such a focus on kind of the now, in a sense that being a very enlightened moment, is because when I think too much about the past, I have a lot of regrets and then I feel bad about that. And if I'm trying to be in the moment now, I think about the future where, you know, everything eventually will end. So I think there's this sense of constantly struggling with my own kind of spiral, I guess. It's always a sense that things are temporary and that trying to hold on to it is kind of it's self-defeating in a way. So I think there's that idea of just letting go of that control and just, like I said, knowing that, yeah, I will die someday and that I, you know, the joy that I have now isn't everlasting, but it is what it is for now. And trying to keep that moment and keep letting go of the anxiety or fear or the sadness that I have at times. So I think so much of my poetry is concerned about giving children in general a certain kind of joy that is sustainable and renewing. And I'm trying to find that in my own way. So I think joy apoptosis is my way of saying that I can't hold on to it, and that's okay. And
there you have the readings from the latter, Michael Schmelzer, the former, Robert Michael Pyle, good old Bob Pyle. And those are poets that many of you will remember from some months ago. Hope you've enjoyed the program. Goodbye. I was your host, David Gilmore.